This is a closed-circuit feed, not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with sportscaster Tim McCarver. His baseball insights, drawn from his 21 years as a major league catcher, have won praise from TV critics and from fans. Also, I'll talk with anthropologist Robert Murphy, who did a field study of his own condition as a quadriplegic. He compares the illness, which brought on his paralysis, to the invasion of the body snatchers. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward will take a look at the erratic career of Louisiana swamp rocker Tommy McLean. And our book critic John Leonard will review The Fortune Teller, the first novel from Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Marsha Norman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is Tim McCarver, the play-by-play announcer for the New York Mets and ABC's Monday Night Baseball. McCarver is a former catcher who began his major league career in 1959. By the time of his retirement in 1980, he was the only catcher in history whose career extended into four decades. He describes the position as the most demanding, underestimated job in sports. McCarver caught for some of the best pitchers of his time, including Cardinals Hall of Famer Bob Gibson and Phillies Cy Young winner Steve Carlton. During the many years that Carlton shunned the press, it fell to McCarver to provide the post-game analysis of the pitcher's performance. In his current sportscasting work, McCarver has been praised by media critics for avoiding the old tired cliches. Instead, he provides a more thoughtful, analytical game call. McCarver has just written a baseball memoir. It's titled Baby, I Love It. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry. Nice being with you.
Are there any permanent changes in your anatomy from having crouched and caught for so many years?
I don't know whether there are permanent changes in my anatomy. I know that I can tell when it's raining outside without opening the shutters. I know when it's snowing and what the temperature is going to be like before I go outside. From catching, I have arthritis and in the knees. Even though I never had a major or serious knee injury, I was never cut on. The only time I was on the disabled list, as a matter of fact, was back in 1970 when Willie Mays fouled a ball back into my right hand and broke it, and I was out for 4 months. And I'm kind of proud. I think more proud of that fact than I am of anything in my career because of my durability. I'm glad I was durable.
Can I see your hands?
Sure.
They look, can you
normal,
turn them over? Let me see the palms of your hands. They look normal. I wasn't, after having the ball pound against your hand for so many years, I thought they might be more gnarled.
The particular mitts that I used, I think, aided and abetting a longer living left hand, because the pitchers that you catch throw awfully hard, and when you catch the ball away from the bone right below your index finger, it takes some of the cushion. It kind of cushions the blow and takes some of the sting and bite away. My left thumb is in pretty bad shape and hyperextended. But I feel fortunate in that I was able to play 21 years and 21 years in the big leagues for the most part without having a serious injury.
What is so grueling about catching?
Squatting, the foul tips, the mental strain as much as anything. I mean, the feeling that you have to concern yourself with other people. A shortstop really has to worry about catching the ball and throwing the ball. He has some, he's got to make some moves with his second baseman, that a little rhythm and timing moves. Outfielders have to work with guys, but a catcher really has to work with his pitcher. And when you work that closely with somebody, you can't help but feel for him when he gets tagged with a loss. If you lose a game 3-2 and you called a pitch that you know shouldn't have been thrown later on, then the pitcher may accept it and say, don't worry about it, we'll get him next time, but you know fully well that it was a bad call, then you stay awake at night as much as he does. And you're staying awake every night for every pitcher that you catch, you see, because you're going to be back behind the plate again. The mental strain can be as difficult as the physical strain, and there's a lot of physical strain. Balls bouncing up. Baseball's hard. And it's thrown awfully hard. It's thrown 90-plus miles an hour. and it's spinning and twisting and everything. And a catcher in the big leagues cannot catch a full season or 130 to 140 games without half of the time going behind the plate and being hurt and feeling pain.
When you say that the position is underestimated, do you mean by the fans, by the players, or by the people in the front office?
Yes. All of the above. The fans, because they can only vicariously see what's going on, and the front office, because they often negotiate contracts, like the catcher was supposed to hit driving 100 runs. I mean, when Johnny Bench drove in, he won two MVPs, driving in over 100 runs, I believe, four times in his career. A remarkable achievement. Gary Carter, three or four times 100 RBIs. Remarkable achievements, because to go back there day in and day out and then still be able to contribute offensively is just truly remarkable.
Why is it so unlikely that a catcher would be a great batter?
Well, primarily because of the fatigue. If I had a nickel for every third and fourth at bat of a game where I made an out, most of the time lazy fly balls the other way, it beats your arms down. The balls beat your arms down. The strain of your emphasis is on something else. It's not necessarily on only your offense. It's on other things. It's helping your pitcher. It's manipulating a game. It's matching wits. It's there are just so many things that are involved in that particular position other than the physical strain. I think the standards offensively for catchers going into the Hall of Fame should be lowered, as a matter of fact. I used to negotiate contracts back in the middle 60s, and the general managers used to tell me that my numbers were not as good as an outfielder's or an infielder's or a first baseman's. And I said, but I'm a catcher. They never understood it, or at least they used that to negotiate.
From your catcher's perspective, who should the strategist be, the catcher or the pitcher?
Well, the pitcher's the guy who has to throw the ball, and so he is the guy who ultimately throws the pitch. A catcher will suggest very strongly that a pitch should be called, and if the pitcher still disagrees, then it's time to talk, and then only should you go out to the mound. I hate conferences at the mound. I think they don't serve any purpose, and a lot of the times on television, a lot of the announcers will talk about how what's being said on the mound, and most of the time it's for show and not very thought provoking things.
What does it show? What's
well,
the show about?
Well, it shows that a catcher is going out there to slow down his pitcher, to speed him up, or talk about things. And catchers seem to make their living doing this. I remember Johnny Keene, when I was catching for the Cardinals back in 1963, used to ask me to go out to slow down Bob Gibson. And I used to say, John, he doesn't want me to be out there slowing him down. He wants to work at his pace. And so John wanted me to go out there. Gibson wanted me away from there. I remember one time I went out to the mound, and Bob told me to go on back behind the plate. The only thing I knew about pitching was that it was hard to hit.
Well, do some pitchers resent it if the catcher tries to tell them what kind of pitch to throw? Do they feel like they're handing over their game to the catcher?
Oh, yes. And I don't think any catcher worth his salt really tries to enforce a particular type of game from a pitcher. I think a lot of catchers with experience will try to railroad a young pitcher into pitching the catcher's type of game instead of the pitcher's. And I think the pitchers, or the catchers worth their salt, will work with the pitcher and not try to strong-arm him.
What about the batter? The batter comes up to hit. You're catching right mm-hmm. next to him. Is there a tension between the two of you frequently? Would you try to psych each other out or
knock
off each other's equilibrium?
No. A lot of catchers are often asked if they talk to the hitters. I never felt that it was professionally responsible to talk to hitters in particular situations like that. If you couldn't get them out the way the rules of the game were played, I thought it was a minor league attitude for a catcher to take, and totally unprofessional to spend most of that time trying to distract the hitter by talking to him.
The pitchers who you work with the longest were Bob Gibson and Steve Carlton. Mm-hmm. Did you have to act almost like a psychologist to both of those pitchers, just to psych out what they were doing in their game and to help them get more on track if they were losing it?
I think psychologist is probably too strong a word, because guys who are intelligent like Carlton and Gibson, and I caught some pitchers who weren't intelligent, and I'm not trying to say that I am, but Bob Gibson and Steve Carlton were the two types of individuals who would read through things like that. I mean, the one thing that I tried to do more than anything else is to be honest. I would try. A catcher is an expert on results of pitches. He's not an expert on how to throw a pitch, but he is on the result of a particular pitch. And I tried to put that more to use than anything else, the results of the pitches that not only Carlton and Gibson threw, but anybody that I caught.
What were some of the things that you would tell Carlton or Gibson if they were in a slump? What could you tell them?
I tried to stay away from things like that. Catchers are often put into awkward positions as far as arm movement and arm location. I didn't tell them too many things at all about getting – you got to pitch your way out of it. You pitch your way into things like that, to little ruts, and you're a human being, and you're going to fall into little ruts like that occasionally. But guys like Carlton and Gibson, they didn't fall into them too frequently.
You had caught for Carlton in the Cardinals,
mm-hmm.
and then when
mm-hmm.
he moved to the Phillies, they basically sent for you after a while, right?
Well, they sent for me via several other ball clubs. I played with two teams twice. I played for the Cardinals on two different during two different tenures, and then with the Phillies in two different tenures. And I was released from the Boston Red Sox back in 1975, and I came to Philadelphia, as a matter of fact, to interview and to audition for two television stations. And the present owner of the Phillies, who was then the business manager, Bill Giles, called and asked me if I wanted to continue my career, and I did. I was only 33 years old, and they were having roster problems, and Carlton was having personal problems as far as professional problems. And so they thought with the addition of me that it could get a team that was relatively successful before back together again, and that proved to be a good move on their part.
Did you feel like you were able to help straighten out some of the problems Carlton was having?
The one thing I did was call for a slider. There was a difference of opinion in the organization at the time that Steve Carlton's best pitch was his fastball. Well, I knew at the time that his best pitch was his slider because I'd been on the other side hitting against Carlton's slider for two or three years. So and plus I'd caught him, so I'd seen him from both ends.
Are the balls that are the hardest to hit at bat also the balls that are hard to catch if
yes,
you're a catcher?
That's a good question, and that's true. Generally speaking, the balls that are toughest to hit are the toughest to catch, and because Bob Gibson was difficult to hit, it made him difficult to catch. Conversely, however, Carlton was easy to catch. You could catch him in a rocking chair. His slider in the dirt was tough, but it was a gaugeable ball that you knew how to block it. You knew the spin and the rotation and where to go when the ball went in the dirt, and most of the time it was not a problem. But his fastball was, you could catch him in your living room.
Are there some fastballs that are so fast that you can't really see them that well?
No. I mean, after all, a catcher has the advantage of knowing what's coming. And consequently, because he knows what's coming, major league pitchers can put the ball in an area about the width of two balls or so, which is about a 6-inch area. And they can do that with a great deal of frequency. And because of that skill, the act of catching the ball is an easy thing to do. However, squatting and getting down in that position, there's no telling how many times I did that. And I'm proud of the fact that I was able to do it. I was gifted with strong legs, and that's why I was able to do that.
Did you spend time with your pitcher outside of the game?
Oh, yes. Bill Dickey, back in 1959, I signed out of high school. And Bill Dickey, I almost signed with the Yankees. And Bill Dickey, of course, a Hall of Fame catcher for the Yankees. And he handed me a list of what catchers should do. And I remember one of those things on that list was to be a pitcher's friend. And that never left me. And I mean all of the qualifications that friendship implies, not necessarily telling him everything is fine and everything's going to be all right and all that sort of stuff, and not necessarily stroking him, but telling him the truth, getting angry when he deserves it, and really having, I think that's what communication is really all about, not to tell the pitcher what he wants to hear, but to tell him the truth, and that's what I tried to do.
I want to ask you one more thing about catching. Would you ever want to catch again? If you were given the option of putting on all the equipment again and catching for a game, how would you feel about getting back into that position, getting back into the crouch, putting on the gear?
I think knowing what I do know now about how tough a position it is, I don't know whether I would have started catching. However, looking back on it with such satisfaction, I'm glad I did it, because the satisfaction that you got out of it, or that I got out of it, was just enormous. I mean, a catcher can go 0-for-4 in a ball game, and if the team wins, he gets an amazing amount of satisfaction, even not doing well offensively.
My guest is sportscaster and former catcher Tim McCarver. He's written a baseball memoir titled Oh Baby, I Love It. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Tim McCarver, you've been broadcasting since 1980. Was catching good preparation for the kind of sportscasting you're doing now? Was it a good position to play for sportscasting?
It's the best preparation. A lot of people don't realize that catchers in the broadcasting booth are virtually doing or facing the field, even though they're two or three stories higher. They're facing the field from the same position and viewing the game from the same position that they worked at it for such a long period of time in most cases. A lot of the things that you think about or that you thought about as a catcher, you have a chance to bring out into the open as a broadcaster. For instance, if a right-handed hitter is hitting and a pitcher is working the right-handed hitter to the outside part of the plate, making it more difficult to pull a pitch, and the outfield is playing the particular hitter around to pull, and you fully are aware that the hitter is more inclined to hit the ball the other way. These are some of the things that you thought about as a catcher, and you can relay and share with the audience some of those thoughts. It's such a complex position to play. Another example, if the infield is shifted around and the pitcher is throwing a steady diet of breaking balls away to the hitter, well, then you should be able to talk about this and tell the audience why the pitcher may be thinking or why he's wrong in going against the way his defense is. Now, if you were a shortstop to become a broadcaster, it would be difficult to do this because he doesn't have the same panoramic view that a catcher has.
You certainly had a chance to listen to and watch plenty of ball games before becoming a sportscaster yourself.
Yeah.
Were there any cliches you swore you wouldn't say when you got started in the broadcasting business?
I didn't use a lot of cliches as a player in interviews, and of course being interviewed is different than interviewing someone else. But I've always sworn off cliches, really. I know in spring training it used to be, for the sake of just having something to say, baseball has its own brand of lingo. And every spring you'd show up and everybody asked you, there were five things that they were interested in. Did you have a nice winter? I mean, in what other business do people talk about seasons? I mean, having a nice day is bad enough, but did you have a nice winter? did you drive down? Gee, your weight looks good. Where are you staying? And probably the worst of all, how's the family? I mean, how's the family? Those were some of the most boring things to even bring up. Not if someone says, how's your wife, Ann, and how's Kathy and Kelly, your children? That's a lot different. But anyway, one spring I had some cards made up, and I answered all these questions and just handed out cards. And I abhor cliches. I really do. And I'm glad that I do, because it served me well in my broadcasting business.
Anyone who's broadcast live knows that there are times when, because it's your turn to say something, you can say the stupidest thing, the most embarrassing thing that you ever imagined. Has that happened to you? That it's been like your turn, you open your mouth, and something all wrong and very embarrassing comes out.
Oh, it's happened to everybody who is broadcast. As an example, during the 1986 season, a season in which the New York Mets were obviously very successful, there was a lot to talk about and a very exciting season for the people in New York City. Of course, the Mets went on to win the World Series. Well, I remember back in the middle of June, there was a ground ball hit to Howard Johnson, the third baseman for the Mets, and the ball took a bad hop. And it was Ralph Kiner, my colleague, was doing the play-by-play. I was doing the analyst work at the time. Ball took a bad hop, and it hit Howard in the shoulder, and it kind of rolled down his arm into his glove. And he made a nice recovery and threw the runner out at first base by a step. So now our director, Bill Webb, comes right on the shot, and I said, this mental image of a mother holding her child flew into my mind, and I thought, well, I'll use it. And a lot of times you just fire out with the first thing that comes to your mind. A lot of these things aren't planned. And I said, sometimes, and I'm going over the replay, and I said, sometimes an infielder, because of the hop, has to handle the hop like a mother would handle her child. Now watch how Howard smothers this ball against his body. And the word smothers came out, and I said, I can't believe I said that. And I looked at Ralph, and Ralph looked at me as if to say, get yourself out of this one, pal. And Ralph said, I think you meant cradle. I said, cradle, that's the word. So certainly you really do get in trouble there. But the one thing I do remember was from an old broadcast partner of mine who said that he had good advice as an ex-athlete when he broke in. His name was Richie Ashburn. And Richie said that somebody told him once that if you don't have anything to say, don't say it. And on television, that's very, very important. Silence is useful and as important as something fruitfully chosen.
When you're in the booth and you're announcing a game, what do you have with you so that you can be up to date on everybody who's up at bat or whatever?
The stats are, you are furnished with a myriad of stats. And believe me, you could talk nothing but nonstop stats during a baseball game, but people can't digest all of the numbers that are thrown at them. That's why I think it would behoove broadcasters to be more human in their approach. And I think that, generally speaking, most broadcasters are changing, that stats aren't as important as they once were. I mean, it's just not a game of numbers. It's the human side of it. I remember during the 1985 World Series, I was very, very nervous. It was my first World Series that I'd ever done. And I was working with Al Michaels and Jim Palmer. And after the first game, the next day we had the production meeting. And I naturally, wanting to improve our broadcast like everybody did, I asked our producer, who's now the senior vice president at ABC, Dennis Lewin. I asked Dennis, I said, is there anything I can do to improve this broadcast? He said, everything last night was great. It was just wonderful. Try to humanize it a little bit more. And I had never really been told the fact to humanize it, but I think that's what people want to know. They want to know how a ball player is going through the same problems that they might be going through if they were ball players at that time. And you can't tell them that by telling them one number after the other. People can't digest things like that. They want to hear the human side of it. And that's what, especially since that time and since I'd heard it, that I'd tried to do.
You've been announcing Mets games for the past few years. Mm-hmm. Do you start really rooting for the team? And when they were in the series and won the series last year, is that, do you become a real fan as well as a journalist and announcer?
Well, I am a human being. I think I had the opportunity to root for the ball club when they played during the World Series last year because I was a fan. And as a fan, I have the right to root. But as a broadcaster, in my opinion, I don't have the right to root. I think it's perfectly all right to be to imply that you are hired by the club. And after all, the Mets do pay my salary. I'm not foolish enough to bite the hand that feeds me. However, people don't want to hear that, especially a town like New York, especially on a cable station that goes through to every corner of the country. People don't want to hear we and us and they. There's a different theory about this. Some guys do it. Some very successful announcers do it. They are homers, they are rooters, and they're very, very good announcers. It's just my philosophy that I think that you are, if you take this as an overall attitude toward broadcasting, the rooter syndrome, that you're not going to give the public enough objective analysis, and eventually you're at some point in time you're not going to be able to put yourself in a situation where you have to tell the truth, and you got to tell the truth on the air.
How carried away do you like to get if someone's hitting a home run? You know, you following the ball, the going, gone.
Yeah, I don't really have any set calls. I was never trained in the communications business, and I try to be as natural as I can. I think being natural is the thing. And if I choose to get excited, I'm relatively excitable by nature anyway. So if I choose to get excited on a home run call, I don't think about it. I just go ahead and do it.
You know a lot of the players' secrets because you've played with some of them. I have secret weaknesses. Yeah. I don't mean their private lives,
yes,
but like
right.
little secret weaknesses that only other players would really know about, or locker room talk that only other players would really have access to. Now you're a sportscaster, and you have to decide how much of that to inform your audience about. What are the ethics of that? Someone comes up to bat, and you know a lot about them.
Well, often teams will not allow broadcasters or the media in the training rooms for obvious reasons. If a runner, a guy like Vince Coleman of the St. Louis Cardinals, for instance, has a minor leg pull or a hamstring pull and would not be able to run as well, and you reported that, well, obviously the other team could hear it. That's why announcers and the media are not allowed in the training room. I, from my playing days, some of the guys are still around that I played against. I just say it on the air. If they have a weakness or a strength, and for the most part, most of these players know the weaknesses and strengths of the hitters. It's just execution. Hitters are not dumb, and neither are pitchers. Most of these things are known. If a guy's a low ball hitter, it's pretty easy to find out that he's a low ball hitter. But if you keep throwing him high fastball, then he adjusts. He's got to do that if he expects to play Major League Baseball.
Being a sportscaster is really the perfect job to have when you retire from baseball. You're still in the game. You're just
right?
Commenting on it instead of playing it. The fans are still there. It's still a baseball life. Do you feel sorry, though, for colleagues of yours who were less successful in making that transition out of baseball into a second career? It's not the easiest thing to do.
No, it's not. I think I don't feel sorry for sympathy is not one of my favorite words. Naturally, I think some are given more opportunity, and the ones in baseball who are given the most opportunity are those with marquee value. I didn't have a lot of marquee value, but I felt like the marquee value that I didn't have, I overcame with hard work. And that's what athletes have to realize they have to do. It's a completely different business on the other side of the microphone, and too many guys think that all they have to do is show up and do a job. It's just not that easy.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I've loved it.
My guest has been sportscaster and former major league catcher Tim McCarver. He's written a baseball memoir. It's titled Oh Baby, I Love It. This is Fresh Air. That's That's a parody of Bruce Springsteen. Tomorrow we'll talk about the real Springsteen with rock writer Dave Marsh, author of the new book Glory Days, Bruce Springsteen in the 80s. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations and the listeners to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR National Public Radio. This is a closed-circuit feed and not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up on Fresh Air, I speak with anthropologist and quadriplegic Robert Murphy. His new book, The Body Silent, studies his reactions to his recent paralysis and the reactions of others to him. Book critic John Leonard reviews The Fortune Teller, playwright Marsha Norman's novel of abortion, kidnapping, and the occult. Rock historian Ed Ward travels the back roads of Louisiana in search of swamper Tommy McLean. And we'll have a news update from National Public Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Many of us have favorite singers who made it big with one hit and then disappeared. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has been lucky enough to track down one of his favorite one-hit country singers, Tommy McLean.
Sometimes a song can stop you dead in your tracks. When you think about it, though, it's more than the song. It's the performance, the sound of the thing, and whatever is going on in your life that makes you vulnerable to its making a place in your heart and mind and staying there. I can't remember what was going on for me in 1966 when I first heard Tommy McLean's version of the Don Gibson song, Sweet Dreams, the one Patsy Cline had made famous a few years earlier. But it sure got to me.
Sweet, sweet.
Extreme record. Tommy has an extreme voice, one with a lot of power but not a lot of control, and the recording is so bad that it's custom made for picking up on a poorly tuned car radio at night, which is almost certainly where I heard it first. But like all hits, it faded, and so did Tommy McLean's name. About 10 years later, I started picking up records from the amazing regional scene that had flourished in central Louisiana in the 60s and discovered, much to my surprise, that Tommy McLean was part of it, right along with people like Clint West and the Boogie Kings and Rod Bernard and Cookie and the Cupcakes. If anything, he sounded better to me in 1976 than he had in 1966. And I wasn't alone. The British were paying attention, which is maybe why Elvis Costello's arrangement of Sweet Dreams on his Almost Blue album is so close to Tommy's. But what had happened to Tommy McLean? One day I found myself talking to Huey P. Moe, the Houston-based record producer who calls himself the Crazy Cajun. We'd been talking about his success with Freddie Fender. "The voice," Huey said. "I always look for the voice." So of course he knew Tommy McLean. Why, he'd recorded Huey's song, Think It Over. But aside from a cameo in the film The Drowning Pool, Huey didn't know where he was. "Look," he said, "he makes $6,000-$7,000 a month just playing the circuit in Louisiana. He don't need to make records." I made do with a greatest hits album I found and figured I'd never find him. But just before Mardi Gras in 1982, I was driving through Breaux Bridge, Louisiana, when I saw a sign announcing that Tommy McLean and the Mule Train Band was playing at a ramshackle bar that evening. I wasn't expecting much when I paid my $3, and I sure wasn't expecting what I saw on stage. A tiny gray-haired man with hair as long as Willie Nelson's and a ridiculously large cowboy hat was playing bass left-handed and leading a motley assemblage of musicians through a current country hit sung by a woman with a tambourine in her hand. But when he walked up to the mic and began singing the next song, there was no doubt about it. That was Tommy McLean, and he was sounding fantastic. I asked if he still did Sweet Dreams. "Oh, sure," he said. "We got to do that." And he didn't even mind singing it for the umpteenth time either. "No, man," he told me the next day, "that song got me where I am today. Took me all the way up and all the way down again, and I'm still singing it." It was a familiar enough tale. He'd pressed up 500 copies of an audition tape of him singing the song and sold them around Alexandria, where he was from. Gin Records, the big label in those parts, tried to find him, only to discover that he was playing bass with the Boogie Kings, whom they had under contract. So at the Boogie Kings' next session, the popular show band backed him as he poured out his soul. The record took off. The young man's ego got the better of him. The dope and drinking got out of hand. Well, familiar story, all right. But here's the good news. 2.5 months ago, I saw Tommy again, in the lounge at the Best Western in Lafayette. Not only was his voice still great, at least on the down-home material, but he's making records with Huey Moe. A medley of old favorites, a country song, trying once again.
I'll change my style.
He doesn't have to change his style. He's playing tonight in Lafayette, and the crowds love him. As for fame and fortune, well, he's been there. But at least Tommy McLean is still with us.
Ed Ward's comments on rock history are a regular feature of our show. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle and is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Robert Murphy. In 1972, his body began to twinge with muscle spasms that wouldn't go away. Eventually, doctors discovered a debilitating tumor growing on his spinal cord. Murphy was a professor of anthropology at Columbia University at the time his illness first appeared. He continues to teach there today, although he is now a quadriplegic. As his condition worsened, his interest in the social and cultural consequences of paralysis deepened. He became the subject of his own field research. He found that he belonged to a subculture that was socially isolated and feared by others. From the perspective of an anthropologist, Murphy has written a book that explores the uneasy relations between the able-bodied and the disabled. It's called The Body Silent. When I talked with Robert Murphy from the NPR studios in New York, I asked him about his condition. He told me that he has some movement and use of his arms, but that he is paralyzed from the chest down. I asked him if he had any feeling in his paralyzed limbs.
Yes, I do. This is curious. I do have a sensation in them of a kind of burning, extreme tension of the muscles. And it's an unpleasant feeling. It's not quite painful, but it might be classified as low-level pain. And yet at the same time, it's perfectly possible if you took a needle or a scalpel or a knife and put it into the leg, I wouldn't feel it. For that matter, I've had surgery performed on the lower part of my body, and I haven't felt a single thing. I've done it without any anesthetic whatsoever, not even a local, not a spinal block. I've got my own spinal block for lower-level surgery.
Since you can't really control your legs and have just a little bit of control over your arms, do you still feel like the owner of your body? Do you have a different relationship with your body than you used to?
My body is now something about which I'm self-conscious. I am aware of my body, I'm aware of its deficiencies, and I'm aware all of the time. And you don't get totally disembodied. There are times when one does get disembodied, one would wish to become disembodied, but I think that the problem mostly is you maintain a sense of body simply because it is such a problem at all times. But the body does become alien to you. It becomes a very faulty instrument on which your head is sitting.
So you think of your body as a problem?
It is a problem. It is a desperate problem. And there are times when one feels almost a sense of imprisonment. Every now and then I get slight attacks of claustrophobia, of being locked inside a body that won't move. There's something else that goes with it, too. And I've tried to write of that. It is a very difficult thing to write about, though. And this is the fact that I can no longer dissolve my thoughts into movement. We do not realize the extent to which our thought processes are all tied up with various physical things we do. Our thinking is just as much a matter of speaking, arm movements and so on, all of these things enter into it. And there are times when we escape thought almost altogether by losing ourselves in movement. I live a life that is, to a remarkable degree, contemplative and meditative. And I was never a terribly contemplative or meditative person before. But in a way that I never experienced earlier, I spend a lot of time doing nothing else but thinking for long, long periods of time. And I suppose this was the genesis of the book.
A lot of people see paraplegics as asexual. Has that changed your relationship with women because you're not going to be perceived as having sexual interest in them?
Yeah. For one thing, I think it goes beyond sexuality and asexuality. And goes into a very fundamental kind of relationship between males and females. Only after I got in a wheelchair did I find out how deeply women have been socialized to be resistant and to be on guard with men. Now, I think that right now, for example, I found out this early in my time in a wheelchair, that women I didn't know would talk to me. They would smile at me. I would get in the elevator. They would strike up a conversation. These were things that ordinarily no woman ever did before. And I sort of have enjoyed women more myself.
That's very interesting.
That at last I can talk to people of the others of the opposite sex without there being somehow or other a worry in the back of each of our minds about what we're going to say. I can even talk to them about sex, and it doesn't arouse any anxieties.
Have you turned toward religion or to philosophy to help give some kind of meaning to the condition you find yourself in now?
No, I've never gone back to religion, although the metaphors of religion very often invade my mind. But and philosophy, not really. I think I've gotten more comfort from Sigmund Freud than from any philosopher. The only two philosophers who interest me regarding disability are probably Marx and Hegel. And don't ask me exactly why. I don't think there's enough time.
Okay. Have you ever asked, why me?
No, I haven't. I think that's a useless question, because there you are trying to impute some absolute meaning to the universe. Why me is absolutely immaterial. I look upon this as total caprice and without any ultimate meaning, and I don't think that God is trying to punish me or do anything else, and nor do I think that any deity is going to cure me. So, no, it's been a very secular experience for me.
You know, in a strange way, do you think maybe you've found your calling by studying the handicapped from an anthropologist's perspective? I just don't think any book has ever been written like yours, exploring what it feels like, both mentally and physically, to be handicapped.
You know, it is almost eerie. I started off my career very early as a student of large-scale structures and the evolution of society in general, all the way from primitive hunters and gatherers right on up to modern civilization. Somewhere in middle life, I didn't give up on that. I just became disinterested, and I became more concerned with the kinds of interactions that go on with people. Then that became a little bit stale, and I realized that what I had to do was find out what is the hardcore I that does the interacting. I always thought that if I ever was going to do this, how would I go about getting the research material? Then all of a sudden this happened to me, and the research material is now here. It is in me, it's growing on me, and fundamentally I found it was the direction of all of my research. And yeah, I now am asking the basic questions of what is the nature of being oneself, and what is the nature of basic relationships with other human beings. And it's been this has been the most fascinating part of the entire venture. It hasn't made it worthwhile. I do wish that somebody else had written this book.
Robert Murphy, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Murphy's book is titled The Body Silent. It's published by Henry Holt and Company. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the show, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
How are you covering the opening of the Iran-Contra hearings?
Well, we have a report from Cokie Roberts on the testimony by a retired Air Force General, Richard Secord. And we're also going to be hearing from three political cartoonists who happen to be in town for a convention. They'll be discussing the Contra story and also the Gary Hart story. And as one of them says, getting down to the truth and to character assassination.
What serendipity to have the cartoonists in town.
Indeed. Okay. We also have, by the way, a preview of tomorrow's election in South Africa from John Madison. Very good report.
Well, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Four years ago, playwright Marsha Norman made her mark on the American cultural scene when her play Night Mother won a Pulitzer Prize. It was about a mother who tries unsuccessfully to stop her daughter from committing suicide. Since then, the 39-year-old writer has started crafting screenplays, and now she's written her first novel. It's called The Fortune Teller, and it's published by Random House. Our book critic, John Leonard, says Norman has once again produced a riveting work.
Marsha Norman seems to think she can do whatever she wants without much bother. She writes plays like Night Mother and wins prizes like the Pulitzer almost effortlessly. She decides to write a novel, and The Fortune Teller is her first, and it's at once ingratiating and scary. And yet it seems as if she's never read any other novel. Nobody ever told her that there were lots of novelists out there, dead and alive, who had grappled with and sometimes solved certain technical problems, like point of view and plausibility and pacing. Marsha Norman just makes it up as she goes along, sort of like Grandma Moses, but also like Henri Rousseau. Primitive, but in the end it tears you apart. What The Fortune Teller is mostly about is abortion. 27 children in a medium-sized American town are kidnapped from a circus and held for ransom. Unless the town agrees to oppose abortion by any means possible, the kidnapped children will disappear forever, probably into death. If this sounds far-fetched, it seems to me no more preposterous than the firebombing of family planning clinics by pro-life zealots, those lunatics of one idea straight out of a poem by Wallace Stevens. But Marsha Norman isn't a propagandist taking potshots from a pillbox. What she thinks about abortion, as moral issue, as social policy, as personal choice, and ambivalence, and tragedy, is more complicated and nuanced than any other discussion of the subject that I've seen. And most of what she thinks is put into the mind of Fay Morgan, fortune teller, reader of tarot cards, clairvoyant, a mother herself, and the lover of a policeman who is trying to catch the kidnappers and save the children. Fay reads enough of the future to be fearful, but knowing the future doesn't change it, and the future is full of revenge. And so a suspense story, a detective novel, is grafted onto a love story, and an essay on magic's black and white, and a meditation on mothers and daughters, and a reverie about death that arrives in a black Rolls Royce. Whenever primitive novelist Norman decides to abandon Fay's mind and enter someone else's, she does so abruptly, like changing a diaper. Whenever she chooses to stop and nag us for a couple of pages about adolescence, obsession, politics, fate, sex, or shopping centers, she just sticks in her own opinion, without apology, and with the lofty disdain for narrative flow that it took Tolstoy years to learn. This should be awkward and ungainly and even presumptuous. It isn't. Fay's voice, tough, funny, frightened, scrupulous, scandalized, slangy, transcendent, wins us over, bends and staples the heart. Love for her is survival, an exchange of energies, a giving up and a healing. Something needy and brave and hung like a Christmas tree with question marks. We suffer the missing children, and they suffer us, and we finally listen to Fay the way we listen to a grown-up Huck Finn, turning like a needle to true north on the moral compass. At a time when most novels seem to want us to feel envious or rotten, The Fortune Teller actually makes us feel that we're smarter and better people for having read it.
Our book critic, John Leonard, reviews television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's what's coming up on the next edition of Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with baseball statistician Bill James about the real meaning he finds in the averages he computes. Also, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will offer an appreciation of composer Elliot Carter. And our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag to see if you understand it any better than he does. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant, Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.